Good morning. We'd like to call the March 16th, 2021 post-council session to order. For the record, we are at the Anchor location located at the Public Safety Education and Training Center at 410 West, 9800 South. We'd like to also recognize those who are attending via the internet, Chief Alan Swanson, Sheriff Nathan Curtis, Bruce Bailey, Janetta Williams, and Mayor Troy Walker. We'd also like to excuse Sheriff Corey Pulsifer, and the director's giving me a note here. Okay. I also will need a motion for approval of the minutes, but first I want to remind you that Troy Cook, we had a closed session, so keep that in mind as that approval comes about, because that basically talks about the length of the time frame that we were not on record, just for the record. Do I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Got a motion from Spence Austin. Do I have a second? Have one from Frank Budd. Any opposed? Motion passes. I was going to turn a minute over to Director Stevenson.
Thank you. Just by way of information, Council, I want to personally thank Chief Chad Sof, Sheriff Nathan Curtis, and Dr. Matthew Checkitz for participating in a selection board for a new deputy director. And I'm happy to announce that Captain Alex Garcia, who was lieutenant over basic, has been promoted to that position and will be serving in that capacity from this point forward. So congratulate him, and we're looking forward to abusing him a bit. So thank you.
That deserves a round of applause. Congratulations, Lieutenant. What's your new title now? Deputy Director?
Okay. Deputy Director. Well, or just depend on my mood.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Well, thank you for that. We'll now turn over the annual quarterly reports to Lieutenant Jacqueline Moore and Deputy Director Garcia.
Okay. For investigations for the quarter of December 1st, 2020 to February 28th, 2021, we received 48 complaints, we opened 25 cases, we conducted 4 administrative law judge hearings, we closed 4 cases with no action, and we received 12 voluntary relinquishments. The first was for burglary, possession of a controlled substance. The second was for custodial sexual conduct. The third and fourth were for lying under Garrity. The fifth was for custodial sexual conduct and disorderly conduct. The sixth was for items prohibited in a correctional facility. The seventh was for falsification of a government record, lying under Garrity, willful falsification of application to obtain certification. The eighth was for assault, DV in the presence of a child. The ninth was for vehicle burglary, theft of a prescription, possession of a controlled substance, domestic violence, and impersonating an officer. The tenth was for sexual conduct on duty, lying under Garrity. The 11th was for possession of child pornography, and the 12th was for falsification of a government record. We reviewed 294 basic training applications, 37 dispatcher applications, 35 waiver and reactivation applications. We currently have 70 open investigations and 57 active investigations. Any questions on the quarterly stats? So for annual stats for 2020, we received 268 complaints. We opened 104 investigations, conducted 7 administrative hearings, closed 17 cases with no action, received 26 voluntary relinquishments. We presented 60 cases to post-council. Of those, 13 were revoked, 41 received suspensions, 6 received letters of caution. We reviewed 1,079 basic training applications, 97 waiver and reactivation applications, 164 dispatcher applications, totaling 1,340 in application reviews. Any questions for that? Thanks.
Thank you and good morning. Start with the quarterly reports. Class 353 was our LEO group that started at the first of the year, January 11th. They will graduate this Thursday. 48 started, 47 are still enrolled. The one that left was dismissed for a physical fitness entry exam. 354 SFO started on January 4th and finished up February 11th. They started with 20, 18 of those completed the SFO training and received certification. The two that were departed, both of them were for academic. They failed the SFO exit exam. 354 LEO started February 16th, and they will finish their LEO training April 21st. Currently, there's 37. All 37 are still enrolled. Our upcoming classes, March 15th, which was yesterday, we had 355 SFO start. They started with 21. One day in, they're still 21. 355 LEO will start April 26th and will commence July 1st. 39 cadets will be in that class total. Our upcoming class, 356, which is supposed to start April 19th, we have only one enrolled for that SFO block. It's supposed to start in a little over a month. For the LEO block for that class, it's supposed to start June 1st. There are only five that are enrolled, so we're looking at probably postponing that class and trying to combine 356 and 357, depending on what enrollment requests come up. But we are low in numbers right now. I anticipate a spike probably around June, and then the remainder of the year, if it shapes up like past years, will be heavy for us. If we cancel this April 19th class, that'll be the second class that we've canceled already this year just because of enrollment numbers. So I know everybody's hurting, so they're probably trying to hire, just not finding qualified candidates. So we're ready for them when you guys have them. As far as in-service training goes for the quarter, still hampered by COVID somewhat, as far as we haven't opened up for any in-person training here at the Police Academy for in-service. But we did run two dispatcher courses, which were done virtually, and spearheaded by Carl Kuhn and his group. We had a defensive tactics instructor phase one and an instructor research, four basic training EVO courses, two instructor development classes that were held off-site and sponsored and put together by departments. And then we have the normal online intox and radar that were done, along with a couple in-person certification and refresher courses that were taught, for a total of 24 classes, in-service classes that were taught this quarter. Any questions as far as the quarterly goes? All right, as far as the annual report goes, I'll start off with the basic training classes. There were a total of six classes ran in 2020, with a couple of those being splits. Obviously, we had to make some adjustments with COVID, just like everybody else did. One of those was completely online for all of the in-class portion stuff, and then we brought them in for the physical skills. So we trained a total of 25, or sorry, we certified a total of 255 law enforcement officers in 2019. As a comparison, there were eight training academy classes held, and we trained 257. So our class size increased last year based off of only running the six classes instead of the eight, but yet we still trained about the same number of officers. Total number of new peace officer certifications issued by post, this includes all of the satellite training academies, there were 746 special functions officers, 425 correctional officers, and 493 law enforcement officer certifications issued. The post attrition rate, this doesn't take into account any of the satellites, this is just the post academy. We sat at 9.5% this last year in comparison to last year at 9.1%. So a slight increase. Any questions as far as those basic training numbers go for the year? in service, 95 total in-service training programs throughout the year, 16 different topics. 2,200 officers and dispatchers attended in-service courses. A big to-do with that was the online that was offered by Post and our IT department that was able to get that up online. So there's a lot of hours allocated to that as well that a lot of department officers and deputies took advantage of. Defensive tactics research was the one, and phase two of the defensive tactics was one class. EBO basic courses were a total of 10. That included the satellite academies that needed that got hired that also needed the training. And we were able to run one EBO instructor course as well. For those that may be interested, we're trying to get multiple EBO instructor courses put together for this year to try to catch up and meet the demands. Two FTO courses, one handgun instructor course, three instructor development courses, and then coupled with all of the intox and radar that we normally do. They were on par with what we've done previously. Online certs, 12. In-person, 9. Radar, LIDAR, instructor recert, there was one held, and then the sexual assault investigations, the advanced sexual assault course as well. That was one class. That's the other area that we'll look to try to ramp up this year, to make sure that training is provided so we're in compliance with statute and we can get all your officers into that training that desire. Any questions as far as any of the in-service stuff goes? All right, I think I'm up next on curriculum as well, correct?
Please.
If I could say something. I know everybody here, the last 2020, their staffs rose up to the challenges, and really that I can't say more for my staff. It was quite remarkable and humbling to watch as they adapted to, you know, the COVID restrictions. And I will tell you, back in March when all this came up, within 2 weeks, John Jacobs and Chris Fielding had everything spooled up so that we could push it online within 2 weeks, and I was shocked. And just the adaptation over the course of the year as we've had positive tests and managing that and getting people through the academy so they can get to your agencies and start serving in communities was just short of remarkable. And I want to publicly thank them, especially basic training and the way investigations supported basic training. It was just an all-hands-on-deck approach. So I appreciate them, and it was, I mean, a test of character is the challenges that one's faced and the way we've handled it. And I think my staff did an awesome job, so thank you.
To kind of follow up on that as well, we knock on wood, we had to postpone or send a couple classes home for 2 weeks at a time. As far as any sort of shutdown, we never had a shutdown. We never had any sort of large outbreak. We were able to isolate cases and keep going with the training. So as to do with all of the safety precautions obviously taking place and the cadets taking it serious, your officers that you hired taking it serious and knowing how important it was for them to maintain their social distance and kind of hole up in their houses while they were attending the training. So we didn't have to postpone complete classes and delay the training. So on to the curriculum. Just an update on the DT, the 16 hours that was allocated a few councils ago. That 16 hours will be up and ready to go for July. Sergeant Perret and his staff with DT are working on getting some research or updates out to the satellite academies so that they'll be prepared for the July 1 implementation. It's going to be very beneficial to that program to have those extra hours and to help the cadets become more comfortable and be more comfortable with their defensive tactics training. Other than that, no big changes to add this council. So, if there aren't any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And I'd like to echo thanks from Post Council for all of your efforts. The director and command staff, you guys have done an excellent job. Thank you. We'll now hear from Gary Cox on the leadership course update.
Thank you for the opportunity. I have a question for you when I get done with all this. First, I'm going to say it's really good to see some faces that I haven't seen in a long time, including Janetta and Frank. Thank you for still being around and helpful.
Still being alive.
Yeah, that's good. Some of you were here a year and a half, maybe almost 2 years ago, when we came to this council after having consulted with Major Stevenson, with representatives from the chiefs and the sheriff's associations, and also UPOA, and the request that had been made to Salt Lake Community College to construct a leadership in law enforcement course. The purpose of this was to kind of fill a gap or that had been created by the kind of disappearance of the mid-level management certificate program. And we were concerned about that because we're not a nonprofit organization in terms of being able to offer those kinds of programs. And we wanted to make sure that we would have the kind of enrollments that would sustain our ability to offer this kind of class. We got the go-ahead from this group as well as those others, and we built a course in record time. Frank knows how long it takes to put together and get through the curriculum process of a institution of higher learning a course to be able to be offered. We've been able to do that, and we're in the first semester of offering that course. This is a 3-credit-hour college course. Tuition for it's only limited to law enforcement officers, people that are currently employed in law enforcement, and we cover a number of different topics. You've each got a little flyer. I'm not going to go into great detail about this, but the quality of this course is better than what we'd anticipated. Scott's over there nodding his head. We had him come in before we put it out and had him look at the learning management system course that we had created, and he was a bit surprised at what we had done. We're doing this in a broadcast delivery modality. What that means is it's live at the same time, same day and same time every week for 3 hours on a Wednesday evening. We do this like a Zoom meeting for our teacher and our students. And this is fortunate. That happened primarily because of COVID, but it's fortunate also because we have students from Weber County, Kane County, Carbon County, Salt Lake County, and they don't have to make the trip to this building to participate in that course. They can do it face-to-face, but like we're doing here. And the engagement of those students has been incredible. We have 13 students enrolled in that course, again, from all of these different city and county agencies. Two of those students have already received promotions during the time of this of the class. One from a sergeant to a lieutenant, another from officer to sergeant. And so we're pleased with that. There's, a high level of engagement. And the theories and critical thinking and writing skills and those kinds of things that are required in this course are college-level courses. And there's a high level of expectation, and the product is really good. So we're extremely pleased. Now to the question. We had planned on doing this course in spring and fall semesters, at least until we saw what kind of demand we would get. Part of the result of the enrollment this semester that we have came because There were a few of us that were just actually making individual phone calls to chiefs and sheriffs and saying, please send somebody. We've got a number of people from Salt Lake PD, from South Salt Lake PD, Cottonwood Heights here in the Salt Lake Valley, and then the other agencies that I mentioned from Price and Weber County Sheriffs and others. The involvement of those students, those officers, those burgeoning leaders in that course is not just extraordinary, but it's encouraging to me as a former law enforcement administrator to see these new leaders coming up and developing. And I'm excited about what that has in store for us. The question that I have for you is, would there be a demand from your agencies or the people that you work with for us to offer this in summer semester? This creates a little bit of a challenge for us, but we're up to it in that it's 2 weeks shorter period of time. It's 12 weeks instead of 14 of actual classroom time. But we're up to that challenge. Would you, as administrators from your agencies, be willing to send your people? Again, remembering, and if you click on this, you get on this website, you can find out that those students are all eligible for state tuition reimbursement up to 50% of their tuition. And then, of course, many of your agencies provide tuition and reimbursement as well. It's really, the cost of a three-hour class is a little less than $600. And so you're looking at 14 to 16 weeks of ongoing training for these individuals at an incredibly good price, especially when they get reimbursed for that tuition. But again, would you be willing to send people for summer? We need to have usually at least 10, usually 12 students in a class to make it fiscally responsible for us to keep it going.
Yes.
Yes?
Absolutely.
If I could say something, just to remind the council, this has been about 3 years ago. Well, beyond that, Post stopped offering leadership classes because of reduction in budget. So we no longer offered it in in-service training. I approached Director Cox with this idea that they develop a leadership course similar to LPO, but with an academic flavor, with academic credit. And it's been an awesome experience in working with his staff, Chris Bertram and Julia Ellis, amongst others. I can't remember all their names. But I personally reviewed the curriculum and endorsed it. It's very good. And I know that, you know, we get 13, and as we keep this class going and keep people going through the system, word will get out, and this will be a very viable program to replace what we once had in leadership. I say replace. I think it is far better than what Post offered in the past. So it's important that we support it as law enforcement so it doesn't die on the vine, because they're not going to maintain the program if people don't attend. So we need your support as leaders within the community to encourage your staff to attend these courses, because we are grooming our next leaders, and this is a good opportunity to start that process.
What is the cost related to the training?
Yeah, a 3-credit-hour course at Salt Lake Community College is a little less than $600.
I would commit to share it with my officers, and then if they obviously have that choice.
We do intend to offer this in fall semester. The question really is, do we want a summer semester class? Are you willing to send people that soon? That would begin the end of
mid-May.
Mid-May is when that would begin, and go through June.
You can sell them that it's 2 weeks shorter. Yeah, that's a good sell.
It's true. If we can have that kind of commitment, we will. We'll offer that. We'll see. I recognize that there are some that are. You're going to have officers, deputies that are going to say, "Yeah, I'm going to go," and then they start working into the process, and they don't. They don't get there. We recognize that that happens, but if we can have some kind of commitment that, like Chief Carpenter, you say you'll recommend that to your officers, we'd go ahead and schedule that for summer semester and see how that goes. But we'd really ask for your enthusiastic endorsement to your people to do that.
And we'll advertise it on the post website, but. Director, you can always cancel the class if you don't have the numbers, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Let's see if we proceed with that.
Thank you very much for your time and for everything that you continue to do. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Director.
And we have open meeting training by our attorney, Richard Jorgensen.
Hello, this is the open meeting training required by statute. The chair is supposed to ensure that training happens annually. Post, council is a public body and meetings are open to the public. For a public meeting, 24 hours notice is required. It can be posted. It should be posted on the anchor location on the building, on the public notice website, and it's also posted on Post's own website. Minutes are required to be kept for an open meeting, including the date, time, and place of meeting, and the names of members present and absent. Not a lot has changed since last year. Audio is required for online meetings. When we close a meeting, as we did last year, or last session, it requires a quorum of presence. A quorum for this body is dictated by statute as 10 members. We can only close a meeting for the certain criteria listed: discussion of character, professional competence, physical and mental health, strategy sessions for collective bargaining, and purchase and exchange of and lease of real properties or water rights. The post council, in I imagine, would only worry about discussion of character, professional competence, and physical or mental health of an individual. That discussion of those characteristics only excludes a recording from being required. The chair must sign an affidavit swearing that the purpose of the closed meeting was only held for that reason. During a closed meeting, no voting can take place. The meeting must be reopened, and then the vote based on the discussion of the closed meeting can then happen. The change that happened after your last trainings that Marcus did is that in June 2020, after the fifth special session of last year, House Bill 5002 amended the statute allowing a meeting to occur without an anchor location. The meeting can occur without an anchor location if the chair makes a written determination that the conducting the meeting with an anchor location presents a substantial health risk and to the safety of those who may be present. He must make a written determination of that, and it expires after 30 days. So he can't decide in April that he's going to cancel the August meeting. If there is no anchor location, there must be an electronic way for a public to make comments. Public meetings must be open, but they do not have to remain open if anyone disrupts the meeting. If a person substantially, seriously compromises the ability to conduct the meeting, they can be removed. And that's all I have.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
We'll now move to disciplinary cases. Renee Spooner will be representing us.
The first case we will call is David Bennett.
Mr. Bennett,
Yes,
do you have counsel present?
No, we don't.
Okay, thank you. For the record, let show that Mr. Bennett is here representing himself.
Okay, we have him that he's not currently employed in law enforcement. He was formerly APMP. The offense is patronizing a prostitute. The category of offense is category B. Post recommendation is a 3-year suspension. He waived his right to the hearing. We have no aggravators. David Bennett was investigated by a local police agency for patronizing a prostitute. The investigation disclosed that Bennett contacted an undercover officer and offered the officer $60 for oral sex. Bennett agreed to meet the officer at a nearby hotel. As Bennett was driving to the hotel, he was stopped by a local police officer. Bennett was advised of his Miranda rights and admitted to offering to pay a prostitute for oral sex. The case was screened with the city attorney and charges were filed on Bennett. On December 8, 2020, Bennett entered a guilty plea to be held in abeyance to the charge of patronizing a prostitute, as provided in Utah Code 7610-1303, a Class A misdemeanor. During a Garrity interview with Post, Bennett admitted to offering to pay a prostitute for oral sex.
Mr. Bennett, would you like to address the council?
Yes, if I may. First off, to the council, I want to say thank you for the service that you provide. I was listening carefully to the minutes before addressing here, and I want to thank you all for what you do. There's no excuse for what I did. There are reasons, but I'm going through therapy for that. I'm involved in therapy every week, going religiously to that, working hard to build my family back up, build up a career, if it's not in law enforcement, wherever it's going to be. But I trust in the council to make the right decision. I trust your decision, and thank you for this opportunity.
Council, have any questions for Mr. Bennett? Hearing none. Hearing none, I'll ask for a vote. Ask for a motion, sorry.
I'll accept the recommendation.
I have a motion to accept the recommendation of the post council. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Second from John Crowley. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Thank you.
Clinton Burt.
Mr. Burt, are you here?
Mr. Burt was kind of. Is he there?
Sorry,
he was trying to log on. I don't know if he's been able to. But we can proceed without him if need be.
Are you his counsel?
I am.
Okay. And could you please identify yourself?
Yes, my name is Brady Stewart. I represent Mr. Burt.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Stewart, would you like to go ahead and address the council? Oh, sorry, council. Go ahead first with the case.
The agency involved is Brigham City PD. The offense is a BCI violation rape, categories E and A. Post recommendation is revocation, which is baseline. This was a default, and he resigned in lieu of termination on 12/28/2018. The aggravators are there's multiple offenses. On January 24, 2018, Clinton Burt accessed the Utah Criminal Justice Information System and obtained personal information for a person, then provided that information to that person's ex-spouse. On March 14, 2019, Clinton Burt was charged with a Class B misdemeanor for disseminating information from the BCI database. Clinton Burt entered a guilty plea on August 21st, 2019 with a plea in abeyance. On March 28th, 2019, a report was made against Clinton Burt by his girlfriend saying he raped her. The victim said she was drunk or drugged and did not and was not able to consent to Burt engaging in sexual intercourse with her. She made an immediate report about the incident. Burt said she participated in the sexual intercourse and did not say no. Charges of rape were declined by the local county attorney. During the post-Garrity interview, Burt admitted his girlfriend seemed sleepy and out of it while he was engaged in sexual intercourse with her. Burt said that if the same behavior would have been committed by a homeless guy, then it would have been rape. But because they had a history of sexual activity, it was consensual for him. Clinton Burt failed to respond to the notice of agency action. On March 3rd, 2021, an order of default was signed by the administrative law judge and mailed to Burt.
Would you like to address?
Just briefly, I think it's important to note a couple of things. Those allegations of rape, as were previously stated, were never filed. The charges were never filed. I met with the county attorney on that case, and he told me that he didn't think that there was anything there that warranted any charges at all. On the other case that was mentioned, that asking the CJIS database. Again, that was a charge that was held in abeyance and has been dismissed. So again, we're talking about charges that have either not been filed at all or have already been dismissed. Mr. Burt is not currently working in law enforcement, but we do believe that allowing him to keep his post-certification is certainly in his best interest and in the best interest of the community. None of these allegations relate in any way to his performance as a law enforcement officer, and we don't believe that those should be used against him at this time with his certification. We'd submit on that.
Any questions for defense counsel?
Sheriff Noel.
In the information, it stated that your client admitted and stated that he raped her. Is that true, or?
No, that's not true at all. My understanding is that I think that comment was taken completely out of context. I don't think that was ever the conversation. I was also there when Mr. Burke met with the investigator in that case, and I believe the conversation was regarding his interaction with his girlfriend that they had had that day. They'd had consensual relations that night previously, and that was his. So his conversation was, if this had been someone that you'd never met before, that may be something. But in the context of the fact that they were in a relationship, sleeping in the same bed together, that they had a long-term relationship, that was why it was different than some stranger that he had just run into. But no, he had never admitted to rape or felt that the interaction was ever non-consensual.
Thanks, counsel. We're just checking. It's our understanding that,
was there more than one interview?
Well, there may have been, and the interview that was done by the post investigator may be not the same one that I participated in. The interview that I participated in was when they were doing the initial investigation in the case. So I apologize if I misspoke regarding the interaction with the post investigator.
So for clarification, you were not there with the post investigator, correct?
That's correct. It was the detective that was doing the initial investigation.
Thank you, counsel. Any additional questions?
Chief Self.
Counsel, your client also stated that, well, the girlfriend stated that she felt like he was drugged. Did your client ever talk to you or state that he drugged her, or is he denying that as well?
We spoke about that in detail, and he very adamantly denied that. He told me that both of them had a couple of alcoholic beverages with dinner that night. I believe it was a bottle of wine, and that was the extent of it. So, and my understanding is that there's not any kind of toxicology reports indicating otherwise. But no, there was no drugging of any kind according to my client. Just the wine that they drank with dinner.
Any additional questions?
I sure would like to hear from our investigators on this. I mean, I'm okay with the BCI violation. You got to give me some more on the rape. Tell me what you found out from him.
I just want to make a quick comment, if I may, that he had the opportunity to participate in this process, and he did not. I mean, he could have, if he wanted to contest it, he could have participated.
And I can speak to that as well. I had actually been in contact with Sergeant Timpson about filing the request for an administrative hearing. There was a mix-up on my part. I provided Sergeant Timpson with a phone number that wasn't my current office, and so there was some miscommunication, and we didn't file the request in time, and that's on me. I think Mr. Burt certainly reached out to me and let me know what was happening within the allotted time, and I spoke with Sergeant Timpson, but I didn't file the request in a timely manner, and as I say, that's my fault, not Mr. Burt's.
Lieutenant Crowley, do you have a question?
I've got a question. It's just set it up on here. Bert told her they had sex and he was the aggressor. He further stated that she was not alert.
And we continue.
Can you answer that, counsel?
Well, I can tell you what my conversations with Mr. Bert were, and as well as his conversation with the detective. In that conversation, he said that they had previously had sex prior to going to sleep, and then that at some point during the night he had woke her up, and that's when they had a second sexual encounter. And so when he said that she was asleep or seemed out of it, he meant that initially when he woke her up to initiate the second sexual encounter. And again, I think aggressor may be the wrong term. I think he may have made the advances for sure, in the sense that he woke her up and then they engaged in sex a second time.
He participated in the criminal investigation, and then he participated in the Garrity interview with Post, but you weren't part of that, right?
Correct.
Have you reviewed the notice of agency action, the details?
Yes, I did.
So he did make admissions to girlfriend number two about the incident, didn't he? Where he said that she had passed out when speaking about the first girlfriend that was the victim of the alleged rape?
Again, no, that wasn't my understanding of the conversation or the way that I had read that. I don't think that he had made any admission. I think he explained what her allegations were. That was not an admission on his end of,
She acknowledged that he acknowledged that she was passed out, and he continued the sexual activity, right?
I'm sorry.
He acknowledged that she had passed out, but yet he continued the sexual activity.
Again, that's not my understanding from Mr. Burt, that may be what it says in there, but that's not based on any conversations I've had with Mr. Burt, and that's certainly not his contention.
Is his contention that it was okay because they had a prior sexual relationship? That's his contention here?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
His contention is that this is fine because they had previously engaged in sexual conduct?
Again, that's taken out of context. He's not saying that having sex with an unwilling participant is okay because they had a previous sexual relationship. I think what he was saying is that in the context of the fact that they were in bed together and that they just slept, had sex, he felt that rolling over and waking her up and seeing if she wanted to engage in another encounter was appropriate. What he was saying is that he wouldn't have gone and woken up a random person and said, "Hey, let's have sex." So that's a very, again, a very different different understanding there.
I think the problem that I'm having is the factual scenario that you're putting forth is contrary to what it was included in the notice of agency action. I don't think that, unless I'm missing something, there was any indication that there had been one instance of sex, somebody fell asleep, and then there was a second one. The way that this reads was that they had been drinking and that she was inebriated to the point that she couldn't walk up the stairs. They laid down and then the sexual encounter started, and then there is some recognition that she's out of it and he was sleepy. So I think that that's where the disconnect is. And I don't think that we have anything before us that gives any facts other than what we've been presented with here.
And my understanding was that the counsel had access to the report materials that were initially filed with the case. And I can certainly provide those. I think that those include additional information regarding the partnership as a whole. And again, everything that led up to the incident in question. And that report, it does talk about, again, the prior sexual encounter that night, prior to them going to sleep, and as well as their, I guess, the nature of their relationship in general.
This is Bruce Bailey. I have a question for counsel.
Go ahead, Bruce.
In the statement, it says that because they had consensual sex one time, that because she didn't say no or didn't retract her consent, that it sounded like he feels he could do whatever he wants to as long as there's no retraction. Is that the case?
No, absolutely not. And again, I think that the comment there is being taken out of context slightly, in the sense that Mr. Burt's explanation was that they'd had previously had sexual relationship, that they'd had sex that night, that they were sleeping in the same bed, that it was appropriate, if you will, for him to again wake her up, nudge her, see if she wanted to have a sexual encounter again. So he's saying that the act of propositioning his partner encounter was appropriate, given that they seemed to be on good terms. And if it was taken as such, I think that there was clearly some misunderstanding. But he's certainly not saying that once you have sex with someone one time that it's a free for all moving forward. That's absolutely not Mr. Burt's belief or understanding.
But that's what he said in the statement.
And again, like I said, I think that that's taken out of context, or at the very least, it's being misconstrued. If the conversation was anything like the investigation with the detective or with the prosecutor, that was certainly not the message that was being relayed by Mr. Burt.
Thank you.
Any further questions for counsel? Hearing none, Ms. Spire.
I have one. Oh. This is Mayor Walker.
Oh, Mayor, please.
Yeah. Is this the same woman that he met with the database in leading and getting the date? Is this a different woman or same woman?
No, it's a different individual.
Okay.
Anything else? I'll go ahead and move forward. Sergeant, would you like to address post?
So it was the same woman. There were
the mic.
It was the same woman that was involved in the DCI violation and this incident.
They were the same.
They were the same.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions for the sergeant?
You had a question before about,
yes, sir.
Would you like me to,
yes,
elaborate,
I would,
please? So part of the difference between the criminal investigation and the post-investigation is Clinton Burt was placed under Garrity. In that case, he is compelled to tell more information more freely than he is in a criminal investigation where it might be against his penal interest. In that post-interview, he made different comments that you have in the notice of action that addresses his state of mind and his behavior as related to what her demeanor was during the interaction, including, you know, if the person up the road had off the street come in and done it, it could have been rage. He also said that he put her underwear back on her and put a towel between her legs.
Such same for later.
Those types of comments indicate that she is not responsive, that she is not able to do those behaviors herself, and so she would not be able to consent to what it is.
Thank you for that clarification.
Ms. Spinner?
Yes, I would also like to point out that Sergeant Timpson gave them additional time to respond. He notified them. He contacted them. He's saying, we're going to default you. I felt like he bent over backwards to accommodate him so they could file a response timely, so we're not here to try and, you know, litigate the facts of the rape. He can, if he disagrees with what happened, he can file an appeal after the sanctions.
Thank you. Any additional questions?
I'm ready to make a motion, Mr. Chair, when you're ready.
Go ahead with the motion.
I make a motion we follow post investigator's recommendation to revocation for Clinton Burt.
We've got a motion from Chief Chad Soap for revocation.
I'll second it.
I've got a second from Lieutenant Crowley. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
Who, and who's opposed? Was that a late? Was that an opposed?
If you're talking about Mayor Walker, no, that was an aye.
Okay, thank you. It was just a little late there. Thank you. any further discussion? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you.
So our next case is Ron DeMille.
For the record, Mr. DeMille, do you have counsel present as well? Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Ms. Spinner. The agency involved is the Department of Corrections. The offense is sexual conduct on duty. It's a Category B. POST is recommending a 3.5-year suspension, which is 6 months more than the baseline due to multiple instances. This went to a hearing, and he is still employed by the Department of Corrections. On February 14, 2019, Lieutenant Ron DeMille was investigated by his department for the allegation of inappropriate sexual behavior, which occurred in 2016. during a department Garrity interview with DeMille, where he said there were frequent occasions where he would go get turned so on by the flirty conversations with his female co-workers that he would retreat to a staff restroom and masturbate to relieve himself. DeMille's department sustained the allegation of masturbating in the staff restroom. DeMille did not participate in the post-investigative process. On January 20th, 2021, a hearing was held before the administrative law judge. The ALJ subsequently issued findings of fact and conclusions of law stating DeMille violated Utah Code Annotated Section 53-6-211. And I would like to also bring to your attention that there's a letter of recommendation from Mike Haddon, and he's not the current director, so it wasn't placed on Department of Corrections letterhead. And I also want to bring to the council's attention that an interlocutory appeal was filed on this case. It was denied on March 11th by the Court of Appeals.
So I will say for the record that former director Mike Haddon endorses the action. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Endorses the
letter of support
on behalf of the accused. So if you want to take a minute and read that in the interim, I will also Director Nelson, Brian Nelson, will recuse himself from this action.
I'd like just to correct myself. The motion that was denied by the Court of Appeals was the emergency motion.
So for the record, where we had a transition in leadership, the current director would have to approve allowing the letter to be read, if I'm not mistaken. So if you're good with that, director? Okay. And then the director will recuse himself as far as action on this. If you would take a minute and read the letter, and then we'll proceed. Thank you. You had a chance to review the letter. I'll give you a couple more minutes. Council, are you ready?
Yes, yes, Chairman. All right, so this one's different from probably any other case that we've dealt with so far, at least on our end with the FOP, and that's because of how the ALJ's order is structured. If you want to turn to page 10 of the ALJ's order. It talks about a constitutional defense under Lawrence v. Texas, where the holdings, and the ALJ actually does a really good job of flushing out the issue here. But basically, Lawrence v. Texas says that consenting adults in the home, or the court recognized a right to privacy when there's consenting adults in a home, and they recognized what they called private places. So, but what the ALJ said was that he couldn't decide this issue because it's beyond the power of adjudication to provide the requested relief. And then at the bottom of page 10, if you just read there, it says, in essence, the mill is suggesting that the existing case law on privacy rights be extended to include workplace bathrooms. This is not an unreasonable request and may be a winning argument, but it is certainly outside the power of the administrative adjudication process to extend privacy rights into uncharted territory. So, what I'm reading into this is that the ALJ is acknowledging that there very well could be a privacy interest here, and that Mr. DeMille's constitutional rights could be violated by punishing him here, but he doesn't feel like he has the authority to extend Lawrence versus Texas in this manner. I disagree with him on that point. I think under the UAPA, he does have authority to decide these, and so that's a point of disagreement here. Under the UAPA, a court can consider whether the person seeking judicial review has been prejudiced by the agency action, if it's unconstitutional on its face or is applied, but also whether or not the agency has decided all the issues requiring resolution. So here we have an issue that the ALJ's pointed out really well. He says, I can't decide this, so it's doesn't have a resolution. So you guys do not have a complete order to base your decision off of, which is a little problematic as I see it from your position. But one of the things that's required is that the agency does decide all the issues requiring resolution. So it's kind of a catch-22 here, where we're trying to decide what kind of punishment is appropriate, knowing that there's this open issue. Next thing I'd point out to you is under the post rules, R728409-4, it's investigative procedure. It says the division may not investigate conduct that is limited to sexual activity protected under the right of privacy recognized by the United States Supreme Court in Lawrence v. Texas. So that's an actual post rule saying that the division doesn't investigate those things. So really the question that we all need an answer to is there a right to privacy in a workplace bathroom where there's a single door, it's shut, there's a lock. Is there a right to privacy in the bathroom? And is POST going to start investigating in what employees' conduct in the bathroom, right? So so that's the central issue here. I think that POST counsel could say that this is outside the jurisdiction of POST because this is really a subject matter jurisdiction issue according to the rule here. It says the division may not investigate conduct. So I think if post counsel wished, they could simply rule that this is beyond the subject matter jurisdiction of post to even investigate. but assuming we get past that point and we want a ruling today, then what we'd ask for is a letter of caution, both based on the letter from Director Haddon and the fact that this is an open constitutional question that the ALJ has kind of signaled he thinks there should be a right to privacy in the bathroom. I'm going to stop right there for just a moment. Are there any questions from the council at this point?
Are you a counselor for him? Who are you? I don't know who you are.
Thank you for asking. My name is Rich Willie. I'm an attorney for Ron DeMille.
Okay. and you're telling me that he has a right to a privacy in a Utah State prison?
That's what I'm saying. Is in a workplace bathroom, there is a right to privacy in a workplace bathroom. I think that right to privacy that's discussed in Lawrence versus Texas, I think that it would extend to a bathroom. And you know, quite honestly, it's a little creepy for an employer to investigate what's going on sexually in the bathroom when it's one person. There's really no way for the public to find out. There's no.
Could he invite a coworker in to have oral sex with him?
So that's a little bit different question, right? So I think the case law, discusses sex on duty between two people as having more repercussions, and that's more because it can affect the good order and discipline of the organization as a whole, because now you have potential workplace drama. You've got all the emotional fallout that occurs from this, and so the courts have given employers the right to regulate sex on duty. So to that question, yes, but this is a single person in a bathroom by himself, nobody knew about before, and the only reason that came out was because of his desire to be honest during an interview.
In the information, it gives a definition of sexual conduct. Sexual conduct is the sexual desire of any person, regardless of the sex of any participant. Mm-hmm. So is this what the behavior that he conducted, is that considered sexual conduct?
So the ALJ did speak to that, and he ruled that it was. We argued during that hearing that it shouldn't be considered sexual conduct, because as we read that statute and those rules, we read that as requiring two people, as the rules are written, and not one person.
But that's not what the definition says. It says the part of the genitals of a person, or the touching of the breast of a female, whether or not through clothing, with the intent to arouse or gratify her, of any person.
And that's what the ALJ ruled. So that's how he came down on that particular issue.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Victoria.
Which I know we probably disagree, but I think my comment or question is premised on the fact that I think that this is different than Lawrence, because Lawrence effectively dealt with private conduct within the confines of the home. I know there's dicta, but where this is coming from, I guess what I'm asking is, isn't what you're asking for the effect going to be that every administrator in this room, every administrator in the state, has to be okay with every uniformed law enforcement officer masturbating in a bathroom, whether it's at the prison, whether it's at their lunch break, whether it's at a gas station? And isn't there going to be I guess I'm just having a hard time squaring some of the fallout that's going to come with that. If a uniformed officer walks into a gas station bathroom, goes in, conducts this kind of engages in this kind of conduct, rather, and the whole point of this sex on duty provision is to try and instill confidence in our officers, and they've decided that this is a certain type of behavior that certainly undermines that confidence. So I think, I guess what I'm saying is, if we adopt what you're saying, it opens the door for all of that, and how is that going to be good for the profession?
So I guess I would just respond with the following: is the employer should be concerned with the rights of privacy of their employees, and regulating what happens in a single person locked bathroom shouldn't really be within the purview of what an employer regulates. I mean, and to the extent that we say we should be regulating what's happening in there, where does it end, right? I mean, at least intuitively, we regard this as a private space, and so I mean, where does it end, right? The bottom.
I understand that. I'm very cognizant of the fact there has to be some of those kind of things, but I guess what I don't.
Do we put cameras in bathrooms? Can we do that?
I mean, because that's the next step.
I don't know that
if we're going to regulate bathroom behavior, how do we know what's going on in the bathroom if we don't put cameras in there?
I don't know that it is the next step. I am just saying that in these instances, I think that there are going to be other indicators outside that are going to be observable outside some of these areas. So like a dressing room, a bathroom stall, there's going to be other indications that this activity in some instances is going on there.
And those are degrees of privacy. So in certain situations, like in a locker room where people are coming in and out and it's, you know, you've got partitions and things, that you're going to have a lower expectation of privacy there than you would, you know, in a single room, locked door, stall bathroom. So I would argue that the expectation of privacy kind of changes where you're at.
In one seater, single stall, locking door kind of scenario, that's different than a bunch of stalls. So it's okay. It's okay in that scenario, but not okay in the other.
The other situation isn't before us. I'm saying where we are at, where it's a single room, that's a place where you would expect to have the highest amount of privacy of virtually anywhere in that building.
It's not comparable, and everything that we have on search and seizure and everything else tells us that expectations of privacy as you leave the home are obviously going to decrease. So I'm just saying that there is a practical problem with imposing the rule, even narrowed down, as you've said, because I don't think these employers can say, all right, well, you can masturbate, but you've got to make sure it's a single bathroom, closed door, and locked, but you can't do it if it's the bathroom stall, you know, where there you can see the feet of other people.
The question is, how is information coming out of the bathroom, right? So if there's people that are... If there's ways for this information to get out, like in an open stall bathroom or something, there's ways for that to affect the efficiency of the organization. Where it's a locked door, I mean, there's really no way for that information to get out, except through an investigation like this.
But what I'm saying is, I don't think that you can that's the distinction to be drawn, because if it's the focus on privacy, if it's like that, I think that it has to do more with, we have uniformed officers on break, walking into an area, engaging this kind of conduct. That's the entire point of these sex on duty things, is that people are seeing this, people are knowing what's going on, and it decreases the confidence.
In this case, nobody knew about this.
And re-arguing the case, we need to proceed. I was going to add that Colonel Rappage is going to recuse himself due to a similar upcoming case.
Was this female a subordinate of the lieutenant's? In other words, was he a supervisor, or the supervisor trained on this female? No? Okay.
Any further questions?
Yeah, just a couple. We have them online.
Okay, we have one online.
And then
post-counsel Richard Jorgensen would also like to speak.
Go ahead. Bruce Bailey, question for counsel.
Go ahead, Bruce.
Just to clarify, so these are multiple events over a 3 or 4 year period while the individual was in uniform on state property being paid by the state at the time, correct?
That's my understanding.
I'll let my client answer that.
For the record, Mr. DeMille will be answering that question.
All right. This was only one event that was discussed during the investigation.
Okay, so just to clarify, that was a single event?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Sergeant Timpson, would you like to please take the... Mike.
I did not conduct the interview on the investigation on this. Having read the reports, though, Mr. DeMille's statement is that on several occasions he got engaged in these conversations and then went to relieve himself in the bathroom.
Thank you. Counsel?
So it is multiple events.
Please let me clarify.
Go ahead and identify yourself, please.
My name is Ron DeMille. I understood the question as, was this a single event? A single event that was discussed with the ALJ, yes. Had I done this on other occasions, yes, I had. If that clarifies the question.
I believe it does. Thank you. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right. Richard, would you like to address? So
procedurally, first the letter of Mike Haddon. Mike was penned and authored. He was no longer the director for Department of Corrections. My understanding is he retired in November. The letter was dated in March. The division shall include comments by the employer. So even though I'll leave it up to the council to decide if they want to consider those, because Haddon was representing the employer when these events happened in 2019. Regarding the constitutional challenge, the statute that the council alluded to starts off, the appellate court shall grant relief only if the agency's action or the rule on which the agency action is based is unconstitutional on its face or applied. I believe that responsibility to determine a constitutionality of the statute belongs to the court and not this body. And the rules regarding sexual conduct on duty, as Sheriff Noel stated, ours is correct as far as pleasuring any person.
Thank you.
So as far as the admittance of the letter, Director Brian Nelson has agreed to allow that to come forward. Is that correct?
Yes. So for the record.
With that, do we have a motion?
Bruce Bailey, I move to accept the post recommendation for 3.5 year suspension.
We have a motion to accept. Do I have a second? I have a second. Victoria McFarland.
I can speak on the motion.
Sorry, who was that? Janetta? Ms. Williams, would you like to speak?
Yes, I've had my hand up for quite some time.
I apologize, I didn't see that.
Yes, but I wanted to speak on this action because I feel that these two, after reading everything previously before today, the privacy rights of this individual, I think we have to take that into consideration because on the guarantee was when he admitted that what he had done. But we wouldn't be even looking at this if he had not said these incidents had occurred. And so it's more or less self-incrimination, poor decision, poor judgment, maybe yes. But I think that what we should really do is look at dismissing this count as well as what we've done on the other two, and so that's my recommendation. As I said, I had my hand up earlier, but I think we do have to look at the privacy rights of an individual in the bathroom as well. And I do understand, what they were saying earlier about the sexual self. Whatever happened in the bathroom, but I still feel looking at this particular case, I think we should consider dismissing this particular one.
Ms. Williams, do you have a substitute motion?
Can I speak to that though?
Oh, wait, Council. Yes, go ahead, Mr. Jorgensen.
By statute, the council shall accept the administrative law judge's finding of fact and conclusion. You don't have the authority to dismiss their complaint. You only have the authority to determine the sanction.
Okay, so you can make a substitute motion for a different sanction, but we can't dismiss the ALJ's findings, if that helps.
Okay.
So I think the equivalent motion would be a
a letter of caution.
I'm sorry.
So, well, what I was saying is I think an equivalent motion would be a letter of caution, and not dismissing it per se, but issuing a letter of caution in this particular matter.
Okay. Well, my substitute motion then would be a letter of caution on this particular, in this case.
We have more conversation with Sheriff Noel. Is that a second, or did you want to say something?
I'm going to disagree with that until I find out from Post here about, I think, two meetings ago, we had a very similar case where we had a correctional officer in a hospital room with an inmate, and he closed the curtain and masturbated in there. I believe we stuck with the recommendation. I don't think this is any different. We're in a Utah state prison, Mrs. Williams, and I respectfully decline to say that he has a right to privacy in the Utah state prison. So I'm going to not go with the letter of caution, but I would like to see if we can find out. I'm pretty sure we stayed with what Post recommended with that individual two sessions ago.
For process, we'll need to vote on Ms. Williams' motion. If it fails for a motion, then we would have a substitute motion. Go back to the original motion, and that is Ms. Williams' letter of caution. Do we have a second on that? Hearing no second, the motion fails. Do I have a substitute motion?
Bailey, I recommend that we accept Post Council's recommendation of 3.5 years.
So we have a motion from Bruce Bailey to accept Post recommendation for 3.5 years. Do we have a second? Have a second from Victoria McFarland. Any further discussion? Well, I'll go ahead and vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
For the record, Ms. Williams opposes. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you.
Our next one is Bradley Louder.
Mr. Ladder, are you here? No? I don't see any.
Just have somebody call in the hall and make sure
that. Yes, could somebody please check the hall? And oh, you have? You've already done that. For the record, we've checked for Mr. Ladder. He has not responded. Is his counsel present here today or online? Hearing none, we'll go ahead and move forward. Would you like to present for us, Ms. Spooner?
The agency involved is Department of Corrections. The offenses are assault, domestic violence, DV in the presence of two children is a category C. Post recommended a 3-year suspension. The baseline is 2 years because of the multiple charges. And Mr. Louder waived his right to a hearing. He was terminated 8/27/2019. On June 22, 2019, Louder was criminally investigated for aggravated assault DV against his wife in the presence of their two children. Louder's wife told officers he put his forearm on her neck, causing her to have trouble breathing. This scared her, and this is when she started to claw at Louder's body, and she also bit him. Louder told police he was holding her down by the wrist until she bit him. Then he smacked her across the face and made the motion of striking something with the back of his hand. Officers were told both children were in the bedroom during the argument. One count of aggravated assault and two counts of DV in the presence of a child were filed. All three charges were dismissed without prejudice when the officer was not present for the hearing and the defense objected to a continuation. Louder refused to participate in the post-investigation. On March 2nd, 2021, Bradley Louder waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the Notice of Agency Action.
For the record, Director Nelson will recuse himself from this one as well. Any questions for Ms. Spooner?
Hearing none, do we have a motion?
Motion to accept post recommendation.
We have a motion to accept post recommendation from Lieutenant Crowley and a second from Chief Self. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes.
The next one is Anthony Powers.
Mr. Powers, are you present? And he's got his counselor as well. Thank you. Ms. Spooner, go ahead with the case.
The agency involved is Ogden PD. Defense is DV, criminal mischief, category C. Post recommendation is a 2-year suspension based, and that is based on the baseline. And he was terminated 3/15/2019. Anthony Powers was investigated by his agency and a local police agency for criminal mischief and unlawful detention during a domestic violence situation. After the investigation, he was taken into custody and transported to a local hospital for mental health evaluation in lieu of being booked in jail for criminal violation. The local police department was called. Powers' mother reported that he was damaging property within the residence and would not allow his wife to leave his site. Powers' wife explained that he thought the National Security Agency was spying on him. She also explained that Powers damaged a glass vase by filling it at a bathtub, which caused approximately $500 in damage. Powers was transported to a local hospital by the police for involuntary mental health evaluation. He was cited for criminal mischief and unlawful detention. Powers later transferred to another local hospital for further evaluation. On March 2nd, 2019, the case was screened and charges were filed with the city prosecutor for criminal mischief and unlawful detention with a domestic violence attribute, both Class B misdemeanors. Powers pled not guilty to the charges. The case was dismissed on January 23rd, 2020, because Powers' family members did not testify in court. The resolution of the case was a diversion agreement. An administrative investigation was conducted by the Ogden Police Department. The investigation determined Powers committed unlawful detention and criminal mischief, both with domestic violence attributes. His agency terminated Powers' employment with the Ogden Police Department. Powers was contacted to arrange for a time for a post-interview, but he declined to be interviewed. He also refused to release his medical records to post. On March 11, 2021, Anthony Powers waived his right to a hearing before administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the Notice of Agency Action.
(Clears throat)
Members of the council, my name is Rich Wheeler. I'm attorney for Anthony Powers. Just want to address a couple points, maybe a couple mitigating factors, and then I'll have Mr. Powers speak to what was going on. Bottom line is, and it's kind of alluded to, but not really well discussed in the notice of agency action, is that this was a mental health event that occurred throughout the entire day on this date. Couple points that I think you'd be interested to know is in the notice of agency action. It says that the charges were dismissed because Mr. Powers' family were unwilling to testify against him. That's not the case at all, and in fact, that's patently false. City of Draper wrote a letter to Chief Randy Watt at the time discussing why they chose to divert this. And in a letter to Mr. Watt, it says, Mr. Powers' criminal case was diverted. Draper City supports the diversion as, in its view, the case was about addressing Mr. Powers' then occurring mental health issues rather than seeking criminal punishment. The diversion agreement meets this goal. And also another point of interest, when this event started, Dr. Mark Babbitts with the Department of Health was present, saw what was going on with Mr. Powers at the time, and actually wrote him a letter stating, and this was also to Mr. Powers' agency at the time, wrote a letter stating, based upon the following information I've received, Mr. Powers has apparently been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, which fully explains his behavior on 2/28/2019, and confirmed my initial impression that he was suffering from an acute stress reaction of some type. Since my clinical experience and training informs me that most cases of PTSD can be successfully treated, I'm optimistic and confident that Mr. Powers will do well now that he's been correctly diagnosed. As part of the diversion, Mr. Powers went through all the steps for rehabilitation. He completed diversion. The charges were dropped. So he has no criminal charges stemming from this case whatsoever. I'd like to take just a moment and let Mr. Powers address the body and then ask for a decision.
Thanks, Mr. Willie. Mr. Powers. I'm not sure if you're on mute. Yeah, I can't tell if we're muted or if we're having technical difficulty on our side. You cannot hear him? Are you speaking, Mr. Powers?
I've seen his lips move a couple times. Oh, it says so. The text says it says I'm muted by the admin. Is what the text is saying. Oh, you cannot.
Okay. We don't have the ability to mute you, Mr. Powers. Can you try to unmute one more time?
Can you go out and come back in? So also for the council's knowledge, Mr. Powers actually does not reside in the state of Utah anymore. He lives in Massachusetts and has lived there for about the last year and a half. And that's partially to explain why he didn't challenge the findings formally through a hearing.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Willie while we're waiting?
Dr. Checkitz, please.
So there's not any medical records that were provided. There was a
I was a little bit unclear about a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. By whom, and who observed that?
So the letter that I read from was from Dr. Mark Babbitts, which I understand you may know him because your name's at the top of the same letterhead. So,
I actually don't know what you're referring to.
Oh, okay. It's not in the record, but it is a letter that was written on his behalf to his agency at the time. So as to who exactly made that diagnosis, I don't have that information right now.
This person wrote to the agency a diagnosis that he had witnessed?
I understand. I understand. Yes, this was a day-long event. This was an emotional event that occurred over the course of a day. It started actually at the Department of Health because that's where Mr. Powers' wife was working at the time. So he came to meet her for lunch, and he started having this emotional event. An ambulance was called at the time, and Dr. Mark Babbitts was there, and he witnessed what was going on. So he's able to provide a firsthand account. So this isn't necessarily a diagnosis because Mr. Powers did not see him in that capacity. This is more of an eyewitness account of what he observed early in the day.
So he's just making a general claim that he may think that that's something that could have occurred from post-traumatic stress disorder. Also, that this is just broadly speaking a mental health issue, which can be kind of anything. Is there a reason that any sort of mental health records or health records weren't provided?
Right, and so the decision for us was whether we were going to have Mr. Powers come back for a hearing. And he lives in Massachusetts right now. It's a long time. This particular case, it's reduced to just a couple pages here, but the record is extremely lengthy in this, and I figured it would be at least a 2 to 3 day hearing. So for all those reasons, he weighed his options and determined that the best course of action here would be to, you know, simply waive and come to post counsel and explain these as mitigating circumstances.
Mr. Willey, for clarification, when you said Dr. Checkett's name was on top of the letter, were you kidding or were you serious on that?
No, I was serious.
Okay. Dr. Checkett's, I'll just have you recuse while we're making a decision, if that's okay.
I can show you that.
Thank you.
I'm here.
Go ahead, Mr. Powers. For the record.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Matthew Brent Checkitz, PhD, and an LCSW, which is a licensed clinical social worker. I'm not Nate Checkitz, and I'm not the deputy director of anything.
Thanks for the clarification. All right, thank you.
There's no conflict. That explains the confusion.
And not your evil twin.
If I'm
going
to be a Checkitz, it probably needs to be a rich one.
All right. Go ahead, Mr. Powers.
It sounds like it's been explained, but I'm in Boston. We're living in Boston now, so that's the reason behind and the length of this. And as far as the medical records go, that's something that I didn't really want to make private.
Mr. Powers, we're having a very difficult time hearing you. I'm not sure if it's on our end or it's apparently it's your internet and mic.
Can I call in?
Call in.
We can try. I can try.
Why don't you mute that and then just call my cell phone and I'll put you on speaker and hold you up to the mic.
That'll
work. And just stay on there, but mute it there.
Can you hear me?
Is this working?
Go ahead, Mr. Powers.
Yeah, it's working for me, all right. Can you guys hear it?
Yeah, we got you.
I still need to do what I hear what they say. Okay. It sounds like this was already explained, but we're living in Boston now. And so that, in combination with the length of how long this would have taken, and I didn't want to put my medical records, I didn't want to make them public records. So that's kind of the reason behind all of this, handling it the way that we have. And so it was a, if this was something that I wasn't aware of what was going on that day, there was no drugs in my system that was tested by two hospitals. There was no drugs in my system. There was alcohol. But I really was out of it, and I didn't know what was going on that day, so I don't remember a lot of the day. Especially, they said my blood pressure was way up, which was causing a hypertensive emergency, so which they said could also contribute to the, being kind of delusional. But basically what they said is that this was an acute stress reaction related to PTSD, and it caused a psychotic break. And I haven't had any of these episodes since being treated. I haven't had any of these episodes since that time. So, and even though I live in Boston, I'd still like for my certification to be good. I don't think I fall into the same category as, you know, other scenarios that occur like this that are aggravated and everything else, and they're getting 2-year suspensions. I think this isn't even close. And so, and I regret that the situation that happened, I couldn't have done anything about it. It wasn't something I had control over. And that's what I'd like to say.
Any questions for Mr. Powers?
I have a couple of questions. That explanation, who was it that said that there was an acute psychotic PTSD reaction? The hospital, just for clarification?
It was both of them. Let me turn this down. It was both of them, actually. It was Dr. Babbitt said that, and then there was a doctor that released me, and this was provided to my department, but it was my medical release, which said the same thing, that this was a PTSD reaction. So, and the symptom to that was the psychotic break. And that was the Dr. Spencer, I believe, out of the LDS hospital where I was transferred to the PICU, the psychiatric.
Mr. Powers, for the sake of this, where we're going to discuss medical issues, we would like to probably have a motion to go into closed session so that we can discuss this privately with you, ask you direct questions. Do I have a motion to go to closed session?
I make that motion.
I have Dr. Checkett's motion to close, and I have second Dr. Budd. We'll go ahead and let the record show that we will be in. Oh, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and dismiss those that are not part of post council, and then we'll proceed. We'd like to call post council session back to order at 12:18. Council?
All right. I'm not sure what else that we'd have to say.
We can go ahead and call for a motion. I'll turn the time over to Renee Spooner to respond to Mr. Willie's original concerns. I want to make sure I'm clear on this. Original concerns.
A patently false statement that you brought up. I'd like to address that.
Okay.
For the record.
All right. And then when we do make the motion, I'd just like to figure out what we're doing with the underlying findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Okay. Ms. Spooner.
And also, I'm going to have the post investigator, Austin O'Bray, here because he spoke with the prosecutor specifically, so I will have him make the statement because he had that conversation personally.
The recommendation that was given for Mr. Powers was based off the information I had at the time. I tried to contact Mr. Powers' wife left her voicemail, didn't hear back from her. Also, Mr. Powers didn't want to release his medical records for the reasoning previously stated and didn't want to participate in a Garrity interview with me at the time. I also did speak with the prosecutor, Draper City, and he said the case came to a resolution the way it did because neither the victim nor the witnesses wanted to testify.
Any questions for the investigator? Hearing none. Thank you.
Okay. All I have is a letter from Draper with that characterization that I read to you earlier, and that was written in conjunction with the prosecutor at the time. So I can go over it again. Without commenting on the merits of the claims, Draper City hereby makes the following clarifications. Mr. Powers' case, criminal case, Draper City Justice Court, case number 19-11-00106 was diverted. Draper supports the diversion, as in its view, the case was about addressing Mr. Powers' then occurring mental health issues rather than seeking criminal punishment. The diversion agreement meets this goal. That's what I have. That was Draper City Manager David Dobbins.
So not the prosecutor.
No, that was that. My understanding is that was written in conjunction with the prosecutor on the case. So.
The prosecutor wasn't a signatory to that letter, correct?
No, David Dobbins was the signatory to that letter.
Any further questions?
If I may add, the reason why I wanted that information out. You can hear me?
Yeah.
The reason why I wanted that information on record was to explain the foundation for which this recommendation came from. We were not privy to the information that Mr. Willie or his client has introduced. I don't know what was discussed, but had we been given that information, we probably would have come to you with a different recommendation. That would have probably been an indefinite suspension for your consideration, but that's just for the record.
And I don't know the grammar process, but at one time Ogden had all these records, including I think most all of the medical records in this case. So if they didn't forward this to you, and including these letters, they have these letters. I don't know why they would not have forwarded that information to you.
Thank you. With that, we'll go ahead and call for a motion.
I'll make the motion that we recommend an indefinite suspension pending a fitness for duty evaluation.
I have a motion from Dr. Checkitz, an indefinite suspension pending a fitness for duty evaluation from a qualified medical examiner. Do I have a second? I've got John Crowley as a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? I'll let you get off mute. Sorry about that. Any opposed?
Won't oppose, but I will. The letter that he spoke about at LDS, that is not a qualified, in my opinion. I think we need to have a fit for duty.
But so for clarification, a qualified physician to...
Okay, understood.
Thank you. Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Jason Sparks.
Jason Sparks, are you here? Or your counsel? I see no one rising. Mr. Sparks, are you on virtually? Or is your counsel here virtually? I see no one. With that, I'll go ahead and turn the time over to you, counsel.
Thank you. The agency involved is South Salt Lake PD. The offense is sexual battery, a Category C. Post is recommending a 3.5-year suspension, and the baseline is a 2-year because of the aggravators. Prior post case involving DV conduct equivalent to a Class A misdemeanor in Utah. Mr. Sparks was terminated 10/7/2019. On May 12, 2019, Jason Sparks, a law enforcement officer with the South Salt Lake Police Department, was investigated for misdemeanor sexual abuse while in Washington, D.C. The criminal investigation was conducted by the Metropolitan Police Department. A prosecutor declined to file a charge against Sparks due to insufficient evidence. An administrative investigation was conducted by members of the South Salt Lake Police Department. Sparks confessed to committing misdemeanor sexual abuse by touching the victim's buttocks without permission, being highly intoxicated, and urinating in public. Sparks was asked about touching the victim's breasts and vagina. He did not recall touching her breasts, but mentioned that if he did it, it was an accident. Sparks denied touching the victim's vagina. He was subsequently terminated from South Salt Lake Police Department on October 7th, 2019. Sparks did not participate in the post-investigation. And I just want to do a comment, like the touching occurred over clothing. Sparks failed to respond to the notice of agency action. On February 16th, 2021, an order of default was signed by the administrative law judge and mailed to Jason Sparks.
Any questions for counsel? Any questions? Hearing none. Do we have a motion?
Make a motion.
Got a motion.
Motion to revoke.
I have a motion to revoke. Do I have a second? Got a second from Chief Self. Did I have something else? Did I have
another second?
Okay, thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none opposed, the motion passes.
Okay, the next case is Braden Summerell.
So, also, just so you're aware, there are two letters accompanying this that are attached to your packet. In addition, there's a third letter that the Post Council has the determination of whether they want to consider, which is written from a captain that is not involved in Mr. Summerall's employment currently. So that is the Post Council's decision whether they want to view that or not. Is there a desire to view that letter? The third letter. In the traditionally, we've stuck with the ones that are actually with their current employers. With that, go ahead.
The agency involved is Carbon County Sheriff's Office. The offense is use of controlled substance, Schedule 3 steroids, which is a Category C. Post is recommending a 2-year suspension. I think there was a typo and it said 2.5. It should be 2-year. He admitted the facts in the notice of agency action with the waiver and was terminated August 10th, 2020. Deputy Braden Summerall was employed by the Carbon County Sheriff's Office and was investigated by a local police agency for incidents involving his association with another officer from a local police agency and suspicious behaviors. Those allegations were determined to be unfounded, but during the investigation, further information was received about Summerall injecting himself with heroin. Those allegations were investigated, and Summerall was sent to take a polygraph. Summerall was unaware of the new allegations, and he went to the polygraph examination. When he was asked about the illegal drug use or steroid use, Summerall abruptly ended the polygraph examination. Summerall then went to his administration and was interviewed by them under Garrity. During that interview, Summerell denied using heroin but admitted to using steroids. Summerell was placed on suspension after that interview. Summerell participated in a subsequent Garrity interview with Post investigators. During that interview, Summerell admitted to using three types of anabolic steroids as part of a cycle. The anabolic steroids were not purchased from a medical professional, and a prescription was not obtained to use them. On February 22, 2021, Summerall waived his right to a hearing before the administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Mr. Summerall, or your counsel? Do you have counsel present today?
I don't have counsel.
Okay, go ahead and address the counsel.
So the reason why I'm here is to ask for some leniency, have some mercy upon me. I've always been an advocate of telling the truth with all my coworkers and basically anybody I've ever worked with. And I've stuck to my guns with telling the truth and worked with everybody that ever, as far with the agency, when they ask me a question, it's going to be basically gospel. I did not, the other accusation with the heroin, not once did I ever, I don't even know where that came from, but during the polygraph, I was not expecting the question about steroids. I thought I was going there for a complete and total other reason. And yes, it did startle me, and I did leave, and I went directly to my sheriff and chief deputy sheriff and told them exactly what had happened. And I'm just wanting some leniency and not a full 2 years. If that's something you guys could do for me, that'd be great, because of my willingness to tell the whole truth and work with everybody that's asked to work with me. I've been more than forthcoming and telling stuff that wasn't even brought up.
Any questions for Mr. Summerall?
I brought copies of this letter from that other gentleman. There's three letters in total, but there's the one, the captain of Price, that I worked with quite often, and I made copies if you guys...
Is he an employer of yours?
He is not my employer.
Okay. It's the position right now of Post not to review that, but they will. We'll give you a moment now to review the other two letters that are attached.
Okay.
Thank you, though. You had a chance to review the letters, I believe. That we'll go ahead. Any questions for Mr. Summerall?
Sheriff Noel?
Where'd you get the steroids? You admit to the steroids, right?
I do.
Where did you get those at?
I bought them from a person that was selling them.
They're Schedule 3 drugs, right?
I don't know the exact schedule. And also, I wasn't taking them when I think of taking a controlled substance, I think of, obviously what I did was a controlled substance, but I wasn't doing it to get any type of high or anything in that nature. I was trying to basically help myself in certain situations.
To be be bigger so you could work in the jail?
No.
No, no, I mean, I'm asking the question. I'm trying to help you out.
At the time, I didn't work in the jail. But I was having other issues, and having bigger muscles was basically kind of an afterthought of why I was taking them. It was a perk, but I wasn't taking them to get high. I wasn't taking them to get any type of high or low or any mental stimulation in any way. I was doing it to try to help myself. And the moment I did, I knew I'd done something wrong. And I'm glad it's off my shoulders, and I just want to get it taken care of, and I just want to get back.
We have a motion.
Is this the guidelines then? Have we had this, any kind of a case similar to this before?
Yeah, have to look and see.
With steroids?
We've had steroids cases in the past.
Any way we could determine what the punishment was, or is that what it is?
Well, we research cases and then come up with a consistent recommendation. So, but if you wanted specific cases, then that would take some time for research.
So, Director, if someone was trying to do it in the police academy, there would have to be 2 years of separation before they'd even be eligible to get into the police academy with this. So
yes.
2 years?
2 years, yes.
That shows the recommendations, 2 year suspension, not 2.5, just for clarification. Counsel, do you have anything to add?
No, I have not further.
All right.
Do you have a motion?
Motion to accept.
Got a motion to accept from Colonel Rappage. Do I have a second?
Second.
I got a second from Spence Austin. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion passes. Thank you. Now, I guess the question being is, how long have you been separated from your employment? Is this the date of?
I believe it was.
8,
I
10,
thought it
20?
Was the 9th, but it was possibly the 10th.
Okay.
Of last year, on, let me see, August.
So would it be from the date, that date? Is that correct? Okay, so they will take in consideration your time of separation from the date you were actually separated from employment.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Any questions? I just
please
want to clarify, because I've heard 2 years and I've heard 2.5 years. So the 2.5 was a typo, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Motion passes.
The next case is Philip Whitlock.
He is not outside.
Mr. Whitlock, are you present here today, or do you have counsel present, either virtually or in person? Seeing no one rising, we'll go ahead and ask counsel to present.
The agency involved is the Department of Corrections. The offenses are child abuse and rape. They're Category A. Post recommendation is revocation. And the aggravators are multiple charges. Philip Whitlock was investigated by a local police agency for child abuse and rape. On December 11th, 2018, Whitlock's 9-month-old son was crying when Whitlock's wife was trying to give the child a bath. Whitlock volunteered to help with their child. During this incident, Whitlock bit his child on the leg to give the infant something to cry about. On July 14th, 2019, Whitlock was investigated for child abuse. Whitlock's wife was in the kitchen doing dishes when she heard the child start to cry in another room. Whitlock's wife went to check on the child and asked Whitlock what had happened. Whitlock told her that the kids were fighting over a toy. Later that night, Whitlock's wife found a bite mark on the child's leg. As part of the investigation, Whitlock participated in a computer voice stress analysis which showed indications of deceit when asked about biting the child. Whitlock denied that he bit the child on July 14, 2019, but admitted to biting the child on December 11, 2018. On January 16, 2020, Whitlock's wife reported to the investigators that Whitlock had raped her after their baby was born in 2018. Whitlock's wife and their and the son was born in March of 2018 by cesarean section, and she was told not to engage in sexual activity for 6 weeks by her doctor. She told investigators that Whitlock engaged in sexual intercourse with her during her recovery time against her will. She said she would cry and push Whitlock away and then tell him it hurt. She said Whitlock would respond by saying, "I'm almost done," or completely ignoring her. Whitlock's wife provided Facebook messages to the investigators where Whitlock admitted he had raped her. Whitlock's wife asked Whitlock in a message, "Did you mean it when you said you were sorry for raping me?" Whitlock responded, "Yes, of course I did." Whitlock's wife sent another message that read, "I don't understand how you could keep an erection while I'm crying and pushing on your chest and begging you to stop if you love me. It does not make any sense to me." Whitlock responded, "I'm sorry, I'll be better." On October 30th, 2019, the case was screened with the county attorney and charges were filed on Whitlock for 2 counts of child abuse under Utah Code Section 76-5-1092A, both second-degree felonies. The charges are still pending in the court system. Whitlock did not participate in the post-investigation, and his department was never notified of any criminal investigation. Whitlock resigned from his agency prior to the second child abuse charge. Whitlock failed to respond to the notice of agency action. On March 8, 2021, an order of default was signed by the administrative law judge and mailed to Whitlock.
Thank you, counsel. Prior to proceeding, I'll also, for the record, indicate that Executive Director Nelson will recuse himself. Any questions for counsel?
October 30th, 2019, and he's still pending criminal charges?
Correct. As of this morning, April 22nd, he has a pretrial WebEx hearing. Part of the reason for how long the trial, the court case has been going was because they've taken, these happened in separate jurisdictions, and so they're taking them and combining them, and then they were investigating the potential of that rape to be criminally charged with those other two charges at the same time. That's part of the reason for the delay.
Any further questions?
I'd make a motion.
Got a motion?
Motion is to revoke.
Got a motion for revocation from Chief Alan Swanson. Do I have a second?
Second.
Second, Colonel Rappage. Any further discussion? Hearing none, call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you, counsel. We'll go ahead and turn the time over to Director Stevenson for policy update, and then we'll go directly into a legislative update.
Thank you, Chair, counsel. By way of policy, I was going to present to you some changes in how we're going to approach certain drugs, marijuana being one of them. But we want to wait to see what changes were made during the legislative session. So we'll have a major policy update in the next meeting in June. So, Chair, if I may proceed to the legislative.
Please.
There's glitter on this paper. Sorry. I've been assaulted with glitter for the last couple of weeks, ambushed, I should say, by certain members of my staff. but I'm not going to open a case.
Is this a confession?
What's that?
Is this some kind of a confession?
Not a confession. I'm a victim, clearly. I would say assault, but I don't think it's necessary to bring a case about. All right. As everybody is aware, this legislative session was very busy, and leading into it, there were a lot of concerns about what was going to happen as a result of 45 days. But I'm going to tell you, it was a very good session. There was a lot of changes that needed to be made, and that should have been made, and some others that were not. And so I was very pleased, and I've spoken to a lot of my peers, and they expressed the same sentiments. So as I go through this list, for those that participated heavily in the session, please interject if I'm off base or misrepresent a bill. So there were several bills that had potential or did, in fact, impact POST. The first bill is House Bill 62, which is Representative Stoddard. It adds some additional language to what the council can consider as far as misconduct is concerned. One of them is involving a crime of dishonesty or deception under oath. That is already a violation, but it was deemed necessary to add to this bill, which is now in law. And then also certain violations for use of force, and then open federal civil rights violations. The civil rights part is procedurally a bit vague. To our estimate, it may add one case every couple of years, but we're going to probably take the position that unless there's a open investigation, either at the federal level or by the department, we probably aren't going to consider that or present these cases to the council unless we get that type of a level of investigation. House Bill 38, which was the Representative Winder's bill that toyed with the idea of adding another position to the council. It was originally started as an FOP representation, and then under a substitute regarding just law enforcement line staff being a member of the council. But that bill did not pass. House Bill 154 did not pass. The original language had some aspects to change use of force terminology. That language was removed, and then it narrowed it down to the reporting time period, which really didn't impact POST, but the initial language would have. 162, Representative Romero. This bill would require annual training, or does require annual training, regarding mental health, de-escalation. 16 hours are to be designated within the 40-hour requirement to those topics. The statute also clarifies that each department has to outline those classes and the number of hours that are related to those classes. The reason why I wanted that in statute is it would be impossible for us to be able to audit or make a report to the legislature regarding who's taking these classes, who's current, because all we get is a number from agencies. So we needed it to be a little bit atomized for those 16 hours. So we'll get the report, and 26 of those or 24 of those hours will just be the hour, and then the rest will be itemized so we can report.
Statewide to the chiefs and sheriffs?
Yes. Yep, to the chiefs and sheriffs and anybody in law enforcement that has a responsibility for reporting hours. House Bill 237, Representative Provo, the language touched on use of force. As it stands now, I do not see it changing the methodology in which we train for use of force. So unless anybody sees otherwise, please let me know. But my staff and I do not see that changing. House Bill 301, Representative Perucci, was a domestic violence training piece. We were given a fiscal note was attached, and we were granted the funds, which was $40,000, to develop a domestic violence course, and then money to deliver that training in service. We'll keep a track of that number and report within a year to the legislature about that training. House Bill 307, which was sponsored by Representative Chris Jansen, did not pass, but it was a bill that wanted to provide a funding mechanism for like arbiter training, not to promote a particular entity, but it was about self-awareness and resilience and ethical interaction with communities. That bill did not pass. I do not know why. House Bill 334 was sponsored by Representative Elison. There's a lot of good stuff, but this was a really good bill, and I'm glad passed, and it's regarding dealing with autism and the training that officers need to have. And I say that word need because we can always use training in dealing with individuals we just don't understand. And with that, I have Cheryl Smith, who is with the Autism Council of Utah. This course, even though it's just for in-service training, I feel very strongly that it's in basic training. So I've asked, we've been working with Cheryl Smith since December or November, I can't remember. And we've gone back and forth quite a few times and had a lot of discussion about the training that is necessary within basic training as part of our mental health block. So you should have in your packets a copy of the proposed class. This is going to be a three-hour class within basic training. Therefore, we need to increase the number of hours in basic training to three to cover this topic. But I'm going to turn the time over to Cheryl Smith, and she can give you a brief introduction to the class and answer any questions you may have regarding this topic.
Thank you. The Autism Council of Utah has been there for probably 18 years, and we're an independent council, but we have support from the governor and the executive departments of the state. I really appreciate the collaboration from Director Stevenson. I have a son who's 300 pounds and 6 feet tall and called Cottonwood Heights, where I'm from, and said, can I come up and do a training? And they were more than happy to let me do that. And it kind of morphed into approaching Representative Elison to get something legitimate mandated for training. We had that unfortunate incident where the youth was shot recently, and I've loved the collaboration that we've had. So I came up with this training module. I've had PhDs review it. I've had the health department review it. I've had the attorney general's training people review it. I'm also on a committee with the attorney general's office in providing autism training. In addition, the bill was for mental illness, and I've had Valley Behavioral Health review that module that Post already has, and they were very impressed with it. They felt like there wouldn't be changes, and in fact, it was really good training already there in the curriculum. So this curriculum that we've came up with will be free. We aren't going to charge for it. We get grants to do this kind of thing, and we want it to happen in our state. So we're more than willing to provide the curriculum, provide the trainer for train the trainer. We'll do all of that at no cost. We don't want to teach officers how to diagnose. We want to teach them how to recognize behaviors and how to de-escalate or how to interact with that person who has autism. I think it's important to note that in Utah, we're very high on the prevalence scale for autism. We're one of the third top states in the nation on prevalence. We have 1 in 54 people here in Utah that have autism, and it's not a matter of if the officer is going to interact with someone, it's when. And we just want a positive outcome for citizens as well as officers in these sort of instances where they're going to be approached or have something happen with autism. Any questions?
Just like to thank you for your efforts here. This is obviously a very important category for us to consider. This is going to be very helpful as we move forward. So thank you for your efforts.
Great. And as a mom and a citizen, thank you for all you do. Go, police officers.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl. So with the addition to the curriculum, it's going to be 3 hours that I'm asking for. I think we would need a vote, as the council is ultimately responsible for the approval of curriculum.
Do we have a motion to approve 3 hours of training for autism training for the
I'd make that motion.
Got a motion from Chief Chad Self.
Second.
Second from Director Nelson. Any further discussion? Hearing none, call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Awesome, thank you. All right, moving on. Senate Bill 13, which was sponsored by Senator Iwamoto, requires more disclosure between agencies. This was a bill, a lot of people on this council have been part of the discussions and development of language. There was a lot of deliberation for this bill, really for almost since June of last year. And this just increases the transparency and the exchange of information so that bad players within our within our community do not get passed on and seek employment elsewhere and obtain it. So that was a good bill to get passed, and I want to thank her for her efforts. Senate Bill 38 requires post-council to establish minimum canine handler and canine certification standards. There should be a copy of a grade sheet that we have here at post. I think it would be premature to just vote and accept these. I propose, with your permission, Chair, that we have a subcommittee look at this between now and the June meeting so that we have all players involved approve this or look at it and make tweaks to it. But essentially what this bill does, one of the conditions is that if somebody goes out of state and receives certification from another training entity, that they have to come back to Utah, and if they want Utah certification, then they have to be audited and they submit the curriculum to our staff. And then we will review it to see if it passes muster, just like an officer out of state coming in and waiving. We have to audit that program to ensure that it rises to the level of the standards established by the council. So no different approach for this program as well.
Director, do you have a recommendation of what that subcommittee would be comprised of who that would be?
Obviously, just, you know, like I think like Chief Carr from Harriman. He was a handler at one time, very well-versed in canine methodology and practices. Sergeant Wendell Knope, obviously, from our staff, who is the Michael Jordan of canine, if I will. And then just various people from the state that you guys deem fit to sit on this subcommittee, and then at least one person from the council so that there is representation on that subcommittee. So,
do we have a volunteer from the council that would be willing to sit on that to work with Director Stevenson to come up with a list of names of those individuals that would be willing to serve on this committee?
I'd be happy to do it.
We have Chad Self, he's agreed to do that, Chief Self.
The silence, I was getting a little complex.
Right.
To work with me.
A little nervous there.
Yeah, thanks, Chief.
I understand it. That was prearranged before. So. Yeah.
Glitter was coming.
So do you need a motion?
Yeah, a motion to support and this concept and then report back in June.
Okay. Do we have a motion to support the concept of creating a subcommittee to review canine training program under the direction of Director Stevenson with a appointed committee that will report back? Spence Austin, we have a motion. We have a second.
Second.
We have a second from Colonel Rappage. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Sorry, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. I forget about our virtual crowd there. Hearing none opposed, the motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you. Senate Bill 98, sponsored by Senator Wyler, was the asset forfeiture bill that was presented last session and then reintroduced this session and passed. It requires POST to offer training in this area and offer a certification, because I believe the statute will require a department to have at least one person that has this asset forfeiture certification from POST to meet certain other requirements as outlined. Also, the Utah Prosecution Council is required to create some training as well. So I'm going to reach out to them to see if they already have something designed, and maybe it's just a small tweak to make it so that we can turn it into a certification for law enforcement. Just by any comments by way of information, I'll report back to the council on all of these initiatives next June as we as you guys approve the curriculum. Senate Bill 102, sponsored by Senator Main. This permits permanent residents to also be eligible for employment within law enforcement. Prior to that, it was just a U.S. citizenship as one of the requirements. So it extends and broadens that selection pool for law enforcement.
That language changes. What does that encompass? Because it's fairly vague,
yeah.
And I'm curious as to if that – it says resides legally, I believe, and rather than a legal resident, which
right.
is different.
I'm not an expert on immigration, but we get these challenges from time to time. I do know to get a permanent resident status, there's a time frame and other requirements such as a residence for a period of time within the United States. I don't know the exact specifics, but I'm going to send out an email outlining exactly what the requirements are so that there's a clear guidance for law enforcement.
I've just been asked on that, and I didn't have direction on that.
Yep.
So that would be great if we could have legal review that and give us an opinion on that.
Yeah, that would be awesome if the AGs could
weigh in on that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll reach out to you later on. Senate Bill 106, sponsored by Senator Thatcher, requires POST to establish a model use of force policy, similar to our model pursuit policy. With that, I do have a handout. So we've been working on this because I anticipated it passing in some form or fashion. So we've actually, you already have it. Oh, it's right here. Now, this was prepared by POST staff as a starting block. I think it would be premature to just approve it. I think we should have a subcommittee review this, but this is a good foundation for this committee to start from. And it's far-reaching, so I think it's important we get all of law enforcement involved as we approve a model use of force policy. So I would like a member of the council at least to represent on the subcommittee, and then we can, if you have any recommendations of who you'd like to see on this committee, I don't want it any bigger than 10, because that does seem to bog down the process if anything exceeds 10.
Do we have someone from POST Council that's willing to assist Director Stevenson on model use of force policy? I will say this is absolutely one of the key priorities for the International Association of Chiefs of Police, with qualified immunity being one of those top two, affecting potentially negatively law enforcement, meaning that we need to make sure that we get in front of this and weigh what we need to do to be responsive on this use of force policy. So I would suggest that if there's somebody that would be willing to participate. Do we have somebody either virtually or in this group that would like to participate from post council?
This is Mayor Walker. I'd be willing to.
Mayor, that'd be great. We'll go ahead and add you to that list. And then, Director, if you could put together the other names, probably between the two of you, make a determination who would be the most fitting to sit on that board. We need a motion to create such a 10-body panel, if you will.
Director, can I get three more of those, please?
Yes.
We need some here.
We have a motion to approve.
I'll make sure you get them.
Go ahead.
I'll make a motion to approve that we do a use of force subcommittee.
We have a motion to approve a use of force subcommittee. Do I have a second?
Second. Troy Walker.
With Mayor Walker as a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor. Moving on, Senate Bill 191 was sponsored by Senator Bramble. This increases the transparency between DPS, post, and private law enforcement institutions. I'll just leave it at that. Any comments or questions? Moving on, Senate Bill 196, again sponsored by Senator Iwamoto. Again, increases transparency and also offers some protection to agencies that release employment information from a former employee. The language in, I believe, it was 5314101, which is an old law, offers those protections, but just for whatever reason, HR and other attorneys that are in that realm don't see that same level of protection. So we saw that we needed to address that in 196. And this is just a companion bill with Senate Bill 13, and that has passed. So
just to add, this is very important for the release of information for the law enforcement executives that they need to realize this is something that gives them the protection. They have a requirement to report that information so that can get before this board so we can take appropriate action.
It was really, really interesting and really cool that even organizations that represent boots on the street, FOP, supported this bill. So, you know, just to test, they want the information out as well, and they don't want the bad players circulating within our law enforcement ranks. So, all right, last one, House Bill 291. That was passed in last session, 2020, and requires us to offer training in the area of human trafficking. The course is designed by the UPC, Utah Prosecution Council, but we have to afford that opportunity for it to be delivered in basic training. With that, I'm going to need an additional hour to the curriculum so that we can fit this training within the course.
So do we have a motion to approve an additional hour of training for human trafficking as requested by Director Stevenson for upcoming post-curriculum?
Ask a question?
Yes, please.
This hour and the other three, are they LEO block or SFO block?
They will both be SFO block.
Thank you.
Yeah. Good question.
But do I have a motion?
So moved.
Got a motion from Director Nelson. Do I have a second?
Second
from Spence Austin. Thanks. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Thank you. Hearing no opposition, the motion passes.
Thank you.
That's all I have.
Director Stevenson?
He's
Yes.
Hey, would you mind sending out a list of all of those bills that affect or have an impact on post council to all the members?
Yes, I will do that. That's Chief Swanson, right?
Yes. And what passed and what didn't pass? I when I was taking notes, Spence was giving me a hard time, and so therefore I missed some of those. So I too would like to make a complaint.
I'll investigate him personally.
Okay. Thank you.
That was Chief Swanson, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Yeah, I will send that out to the council.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Do we have a motion to, well, actually we need to create the next upcoming schedule for our next post-council meeting. Boy, I butchered that one. Oh, we also have UCGIS with Mayor Troy Walker. So, Mayor, if you would like to speak.
I'll just be brief. Thank you. I've only done this now two meetings, these database, you know, misuses of our various databases that we keep in the state of Utah. You know, I think this council does take it seriously. I think it should take it very seriously. Certainly the one case today, the lead in to the connection to the woman was the database use, which I thought was interesting. In my day job, being mayor's only part-time, I've spent most of my legal career as a plaintiff's lawyer, so I always look for, I'll admit it, ways to file lawsuits. And so in wearing this hat as a member of the council and then also as an elected official, I'm concerned that there might be a way to finagle misuse of this of the state criminal database as a violation of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. It might be somewhat of a tenuous reach, but I think there's some emerging case law that might link the Fair Credit Reporting Act database language to a database like the criminal justice database. I think there's a couple of cases. I provided Scott with a little kind of a brief write-up. The only reason I bring that up and want to impress upon all of you in law enforcement is there's going to be some enterprising plaintiff's lawyer that's going to probably try and make this fit at some point. And the real concern would be liability then for the agencies, because some of the case law that's gone, they've held that the agency that provides the access then is liable for the misuse. And we've had this happen in our prescription drug database. I know a fair amount about that case, but I just wanted to just bring it to your attention that, you know, as there's groups out there, there's consumer protection lawyers that are, you know, in groups that are looking to, you know, enforce federal, you know, credit protection laws. And I think there is definitely a potential that our databases could get looped into that Fair Credit Reporting Act, which could tie it directly back to the agency and then of course the city for liability. So that was it. That's briefly, I just wanted us to continue to take a firm position on misuse of that database and make the first offense serious enough that it gets out. I think this council can send a message to law enforcement officers with their view of it that will tampen it down and make it serious, because I think it is very serious what can happen with some of these data breaches. And they seem to be every time. I've only done it twice now, but I understand it's getting more prevalent. So anyway, that's it.
Thank you, Mayor. Yeah, Director Stevenson would like to add to that.
So if I could kind of just echo what the mayor has said. In fact, enterprising attorney, that's a pretty soft description, Mayor. Anyway, I agree. This council has a lot of authority and influence within the law enforcement community. And if we think that people aren't reading the decisions that come out of this body, we're dearly mistaken. People read those bulletins, and I get questions about why was a decision made, blah, blah, blah. So I think it's important that we understand the role of the council within our community. Decisions made go out to our law enforcement community, and people talk. And so I think it's very important. I just want to echo what Mayor Walker has said. So thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. Appreciate it. Any further questions for the mayor?
I just want to clarify, enterprising is, of course, a lawyer looking to represent those who need representation.
Okay. Asked and answered. Thank you. We'll go ahead and schedule our next meeting. Do we have a recommendation?
We usually have a meeting in June.
I think the director's going to barbecue, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. I will feed you next time. We usually do the first or second week of June. What does that look like for people? June 9th?
I'll be out of town, but it's going to be...
Where are you going?
All out.
Oh, wow. What about June 10th? You're saying no?
I'm out that week,
I'll be at my meetings in for Rimmon, Rocky Mountain.
Okay, let's go bypass that week. What about the week of the 14th?
I'm out that week. We move it to the next week.
21st.
21st or 22nd?
Tuesday the 22nd.
The 22nd week.
That's good.
Does it work for everyone?
Yep.
Virtually, we good? Thumbs up?
Yes.
Thank you. Let's look. June 22nd, 10 a.m.?
10 a.m. here.
Thank you very much for your time. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
All of us. We will stand in recess. Thank you.